This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. My guest today is Republican Congressman Chip Roy of Texas. He's a fiscal hawk whose commitment to balancing the budget has led Donald Trump to call for primary challenges against him. I sit down with Roy to talk about why he ultimately voted for the president's budget-busting big, beautiful bill, whether the controversial redistricting plan going on in Texas is really legit, the expansion of the federal government under both parties, and where libertarians and conservatives can work together to reduce the size, scope, and spending of the state. Here is The Reason Interview with Chip Roy. Chip Roy, thanks for talking to Reason.
Yeah, happy to do it, Nick. Appreciate you guys.
You are a rare voice of fiscal shrieking in Hollywood.
In Hollywood, Washington,
D.C. And that has put you in the crosshairs with Donald Trump in particular. You don't want to raise the debt ceiling unless there's a reduction in spending. Mm-hmm. You push back against the big, beautiful bill, although you did cave and supported it.
we'll come back to the word cave, but okay.
Okay, well, you voted for it.
Sure.
But talk a little bit about your general philosophy. Why is it so important that government spending be either held constant or reduced?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, my view is that the power of the purse is the central power of Congress, and we've abdicated it for as long as I can remember.
Right.
And if you don't constrain that power of the purse, then you're funding the very bureaucracy that is what was predicted by the founders and has proven to be true, to be at odds with our liberty.
Right.
So you fund the bureaucrats that are then turned on us. So
why has Congress just, you know, to say they're asleep at the switch is an understatement. What's going on? You came into office in 2019, but this has been going on for at least 20 years
or
before.
So my observation over time is that we're actually at a moment where more members of Congress get it than I've ever seen in the past. Mm-hmm. That's the good news. But the bad news is it's still a woefully inadequate group of people to change it.
Right.
And I think really at the end of the day, members of Congress believe that they get more popularity and votes by spending money. And I actually just disagree with that. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a cancer survivor. I have cancer groups who come in and they ask me for money. And I say, God bless you. I know what you're trying to do. Research is great. But do you have a pay for that? No. Well, then I can't support it, right? Farm Bureau comes in. I love the farmers. I want to protect small farmers against corporate ag and all those things. And we try to do that. But they come in, they want their money on the farm bill. I'm like, well, are we fixing the food stamps? Are we fixing? Mm-hmm. Well, no. Well, then I can't support it. And they get that. And you know what? At the end of the day, they end up appreciating it.
Right.
They appreciate that you're coming in and doing that. And look, I think to answer your question, the reason it's important is to not fund the tyranny that's turned on us. I think more people are seeing that now in ways that they didn't in the past, whether you're the bureaucrats that have been unloaded on the people and through the education, you know, and DEI and all these things, or whether it's just the weaponization of the Department of Justice against people, targeting of parents back when parents were trying to do things in the DOJ under Biden. And those guys were targeting people, et cetera, et cetera. WOTUS has turned on people and farms. Our mutual friend Thomas Massey talks about that a lot. And I think people are kind of understanding, well, crap, you're building up and funding all this stuff. Now we just got to get a Congress that will understand that and peel it back. And, you know, going to the heart of the big, beautiful bill debate, you know, setting up last year, I was trying to work with the OMB, with Russ Vogt and others inside the administration and the incoming administration, a framework to hold everything back. We were told in January, you're not going to touch anything in Medicaid or any kind of healthcare. Mm-hmm. Well, we got $1 trillion on Medicaid. We were told we weren't going to be able to do much on the Green New Scam subsidies with all this stuff going out. We were able to get, you know, $300 or $400 or $500 billion worth of cutbacks to those. Did we get everything we wanted? No. That we can debate, but
I mean, but and there's no question that the big beautiful bill is going to increase the debt, right?
Yeah,
there's no realistic scenario where it doesn't. Which is, even if spending doesn't ramp up, it's, you know, we're digging a deeper hole for it.
I think that is likely the case based on the following facts. Medicare was not touched.
Right.
Social Security was not touched. Interest payments are going up.
Right.
Now, but understand that part of the agreement, and we got to deliver the agreement, was holding discretionary flat or lower. So that was a part of the deal, which, by the way, will pay dividends if we do it, yet to be determined.
Right.
So that's a part of the deal, which I'm going to hold to fight for. And also remember that tax cuts, I mean, look, we can debate them, but I had libertarian friends who were like, hey, I love the no tax on tips. I'm like, well, I mean, okay, but what about no tax on the guys in the back of the restaurant?
Right.
Or no
Yeah.
These are debatable policies that we all want lower taxes. You, I, all every person who wants
I
limited
want lower spending.
But you want lower spending to go along with that. And what I would argue is we fought to get lower spending at levels on things that people never thought we could get.
Right.
Medicaid being huge among those, parity on Medicaid and Medicare rates, a lot of pieces in this that people don't even understand that we're able to achieve. And is it enough? No. Is it likely to create front-loaded deficits? Yes. And I showed those curves and worked with people and I put those charts out.
The problem is it's always like it's going to cause short-term deficits, but then in year 5,000, you know, it comes pretty close to balance.
And I put all those charts out in good faith. And why, Nick? To push the narrative over and then figure out what we could get.
So first, I want to ask you a little bit about total spending levels because they're bonkers.
They
and
bonkers.
I'm not saying you're responsible, but since you showed up, spending has gone up a lot.
I agree.
But what is it like when you, I mean, you know, on the debt ceiling bill, you took a lot of heat from Trump and he was calling you out by name. And then in the big, beautiful bill, you know, also you got leaned on. What is it like when you have, you know, Donald Trump, the president of the United States, a guy who, whatever else you can say about him, has the power to like destroy the political careers of politicians who are very popular in their districts when he says, what the hell are you doing? You better get on the line.
Well, I view it this way. I view it slightly differently because I don't actually worry about whether I'm an office or not. So I don't actually care. Come after me. Don't. It's fine. What I do care about is what can we do in this window of time when we have some people in the administration willing, clunkily, not always what you and I and others who are fiscal stewards, Thomas, Massey, what we would do. But what are you going to do when you've got that opportunity? So I view it that way. All right, Mr. President. All right. You're saying you're going to do X, Y, Z. Well, actually, he's doing X, right? Whatever he's doing, he's taking on this or scaling back some of the spending at the Pentagon or taking on, you know, some cuts and getting the $9 billion of the rescissions package. And there are things that are in process. Are they peanuts and crumbs? Kinda. Yeah. But are they trending in the right direction so far? Did we get material changes on the spending? Yes. So the political influence, it is what it is. But I mean, look, you sit at the table in the White House. Let's say you have some rather robust conversations. The night of the big, beautiful bill, I was with Thomas, I was with other mutual friends, and the president's calling and we're talking. The political pressures don't matter much to me. What matters to me is what is our, how can you assemble people to build a coalition to deliver? I'm proud of what we delivered on Medicaid reforms. I'm proud of what we delivered on the subsidies, which are horrid. I'm proud of what we delivered on a bunch of other spending levels that won't go through the details in. But is it enough? No. We're just nibbling around the edges. It's crumbs.
Yeah. So, I mean, in 2019, the Fed spent about $4.8 trillion.
Yeah. Now we're at 7.5 or whatever.
At 7.2 in 2024.
Right.
I mean, what's amazing is it went from $4.8 trillion in 2019 to $6.8 trillion in 2020 to $7.5 trillion in 2021. It's now settling in around 7.2.
And to give you an example, I don't think, and correct me, you guys go look at my voting record, I don't think I voted for any of that. I'm pretty sure I voted against every one of those appropriations packages when they were
passed. I guess the,
But where does that get you? We have to figure out how to turn the Titanic. And so, look,
Or we have to figure out how to sink the Titanic faster and build a new boat.
And and there are ways, and I am open to those ways of thinking. I think the issue here is, what do we do right now with what we have to give us a fighting chance? Do we need to end the Fed? Yes. Do we need to, you know, totally reform our entire healthcare system, Medicaid, Medicare, all of it? Yes. Do we need to be serious about cutting back half or more of the bureaucracy? Yes.
So start with, how would ending the Fed reduce the federal budget?
Well, in terms of the budget itself, like, I think two things would happen. One, I think it would have a direct impact on what happens with our overspend and interest.
Okay.
Because I think
so basically
the backstop of the Fed,
the
Congress feels unfettered. They feel like they can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And I think then secondly, I think what's happening with respect to the Fed's action, which is driving up inflation, and it has been, that you now have to have all of the forces at play that we see unfolding right now, where, you know, Trump's rattling about the Federal Reserve chairman. There, some
is
of which
that
is
troubling, though, because, you know, whatever, you know, we can, you know, talk about whether the Fed should exist, but like the Fed should be independent, right?
Well, I don't think the Fed should exist. And so independence, yeah, I think, is a question constitutionally with respect to executive branch, legislative mm-hmm. branch, judicial branch. Okay. The founders didn't create a, yeah, oh, there's this stuff over yeah. here, NASA or whatever. I don't, yeah, independent agencies are a whole other thing. I just personally think we need to get back to whether it's gold standard or whatever we want to mm-hmm. do. Now we've obviously got a crypto variable to right. figure out and yeah, how yeah. we want to manage. And those things are all important. Yeah. What we need is we need something that is tangible, that we know we can rely right. upon, and that you can't politicize and then just print money
but
or
that,
borrow money
I
recklessly.
Mean, Trump is not leaning on the Fed in order to depoliticize it, right? He wants,
he just wants interest rates lower.
He wants yeah. more money.
Yeah.
I mean, he wants an inflationary Fed policy, mm-hmm. right? So we're kind of in trouble there. Let me ask you about, the, you know, you mentioned Medicare and Social yeah. Security. You know,
Medicaid,
when you, yeah. but Medicare and Social Security are things that Trump has taken off the table for as long as he's president, which could be, you know, another 2.5 years or it could be another 10 years, right? He, you know, you have interest on the debt, you have Medicare and Social Security. That's like the biggest chunk of the federal budget. Like, is there a way to cut spending or how do you get to a smaller budget without addressing those?
So, number one, this is a technical matter. Yeah. Reconciliation is, we're legally prohibited from touching Social Security. Mm-hmm. So you got to come right. up with some sort of bipartisan way to right. address Social Security or you can't really get to it. Secondly, with respect to mm-hmm. Medicare, I fundamentally believe for Medicare and Medicaid, and frankly, VA, healthcare, yeah. and other pieces of the puzzle, CHIP and these other yeah. health programs, you have to have fundamental healthcare reforms from top to bottom that starts with individuals, doctors, and liberty mm-hmm. and doesn't, I'm not saying liberty because I'm talking to you, I'm saying that's what
no.
I mean.
Yeah.
Literally, my ability to go to the doctor of my choice with right. the money that I have, the only way to get prices down for that entire system.
Yeah.
If we don't do that, and one of the first bills I introduced was the Healthcare Freedom right. Act, which would do that. And by the way, we did force into the big, beautiful bill, DPC, being mm-hmm. direct primary care, being able to be used within your health savings right. accounts. Look, fighting the swamp, fighting the healthcare swamp
yeah.
is brutal because the insurance companies, pharma, big hospitals, they're all colluding to make it to where you and I can't go to the right. doctors of our choice. I'm a member of Congress and I'm on Obamacare. Mm-hmm. If my cancer comes back, which I had 13 years ago, I can't go to MD Anderson, which is an hour up the road right here in Texas mm-hmm. where we are, because Obamacare won't let me go to MD Anderson. Right. That's asinine. And yet, millions of Americans are on right. that system. We've got to blow that up.
Why
and give
didn't
people
the
control.
Republicans, and this before your time,
when
you
suck.
Were working with Ted Cruz, they, you know, the whole first Trump administration was like, when we take over, we're going to repeal and replace Obamacare. And then they were like, yeah, we didn't really mean that.
Look, Republicans in Congress in particular yep. suck on this and are running afraid to yep. touch and deal with health care. I will say this, to the credit of the administration,
yeah.
we were told that we weren't going to touch healthcare at all. And we did touch Medicaid in a very yeah. big way. Those reforms, and people that I trust on this issue, Brian mm-hmm. Blaze at Paragon and other good, solid conservatives on healthcare, are looking at this going, man, we got a lot of reforms that will impact Obamacare in what we fought for in that bill. And I think that's a baseline to mm-hmm. now give us some offense to go on to. And by the way, I got a lot of assurances in the administration. I got a couple I can't talk about yet regarding Obamacare expansion and continuation of the Biden mm-hmm. credits under COVID
right.
that we'll say that we would oppose so we can minimize the footprint. And then importantly, in the second 2-year stint of the term, provided that we have the House and the Senate, that we'd be able to address healthcare. Because it's the guys, if you don't address healthcare, then there is no legacy because you can't stop
right.
the bleeding on the spending if you don't yep. deal with Medicare, Medicaid, and veterans now is
right.
a huge chunk of it.
Now you mentioned Social Security is obviously that is going, you know, mm-hmm. to say it's going bankrupt is not
yeah.
quite right, but it's about to hit a rocky
yeah.
ground, right,
yep.
or something. You know, what are the ways, is there any reason to believe anybody in Congress is doing anything about that? Or
I mean,
is it, we're just going to wait And then we're going to say, just blow out the cap on earnings that are taxed to pay for systems.
So I think something's going to have to be dealt with on that front. But where I've come to a conclusion, especially having now lived through this reconciliation process and fought, I can't tell you how hard to get what we got while then sucking up things I didn't like, is I think Rand has been right for a long time. And others, and I've been there too, but you got to get there about, you're going to have across the board, you know, his penny plan, which now probably has to be the nickel plan for all I know. I don't know where we are mathematically, but, you know, you have to have something where across the board, you're shrinking everything and then force everybody to deliver. Right. So this is actually really important. For whatever one thinks about the Big Beautiful Bill, one of the things we did, we broke the orthodoxy in Washington that we can just have all the tax cuts we want without spending restraint. We forced that in the budget committee. Myself, Ralph Norman, Josh Brkeen, Andrew Clyde, the four of us took down the bill in the budget committee. We killed it. And that brought everybody back in. And I can tell you, those were some intense meetings where we said, guys, we're not doing this if we don't get this level of spending restraint, at least as a model to guide what we do on the floor. And that was before we sent it to the Senate.
Right.
That's actually a big shift. The fights we've had to have inside the Republican Party to say, guys, I know we're products of the 80s and we believe in the Laffer curve and we believe in lower taxes. Of course we do. I do. But you also have to do math. Like you can't just keep cutting taxes and then not do the spending side because the inflation slash turning over of all the, our freedom to government is eating up any of the value you get.
Who are the people, you know, you've mentioned a couple times, Thomas Massie, people like Rand Paul, people like yourself, who are very insistent, even in a MAGA era of like, you know, spending matters. Where's your bench? Or like, who are you grooming, you know, to become, you know, low spending Republicans?
You know, there are some guys, I just mentioned one of them, Josh Brkeen from Oklahoma. He worked for Tom Coburn back in the day. You know, we've got others that are sort of my some of my Freedom Caucus allies, as you talked about, Thomas. Over in the Senate, we worked very closely with Ron Johnson and with Rick Scott and Mike Lee. We were trying to kind of hold all that together towards the end. You know, there are others. I'm going to leave people off, but there are people who are up and coming who get it and who understand, look, we've got to do something on the spending. And I will say, more than I've ever seen, there was a willingness and a belief that we must do something. But when push comes to shove, people they get afraid. They're like, oh, well, we can't touch Medicaid there, or oh, we can't do, you know, this policy. And so we were having to fight that off as it went to the Senate.
Are there any
back to the
Democrats
House.
That are interested in kind of right sizing government spending, or you know, part of it? Milton Friedman used to say that, you know, the ultimate measure of the size of government is its spending.
Yeah.
Because you got to pay for it ultimately, one way or the other. You know, is there anybody on the Democratic side that is like, yeah, this is a little bit out of control? We're spending more, you know, 50% more than we were just a few years ago. What do we got?
I will tell you that I privately had a number of conversations with my Democratic colleagues who kind of got it and appreciated those of us who were holding over, pushing wherever we landed in the end, right? But like holding as far as we could. And we're and look, I was taking a lot of heat because I was putting out all the charts and I was putting out all the stuff saying, guys, here's the real math. And they were like, go. And I was like, well, when will you meet me here? Like, come work with me on the spending side. But they never will on the spending side. They only want to attack the tax side. They want to say, no, don't do those tax cuts, or definitely go tax more and tax the rich.
Right.
And look, I was willing to put everything on the table. I was willing to put, as much as I don't really love it, a higher top marginal rate for the top X earners if I could get more spending restraint. If that would be a deal that we could cut, I'll listen. It's politics. But I couldn't get Democrats to agree with us on anything on the spending restraint side. So we have work to do there. I hope there's a little religion that's, you know, being found by some of my Democrat colleagues on that. Because there used to be guys that you could go sit down back in, you know, in the years past and do that. But I don't know. It's hard to find. I've got a lot of agreement on things like stock trading among members of Congress, other issues where I can work on a bipartisan basis, but this one's tougher.
You know, we're talking in Lake Jackson, Texas.
Yeah.
The event that we're both here at is the 90th birthday party slash barbecue, the Young Americans for Liberty and the Ron Paul Institute.
Sure.
We're doing for Ron Paul. Can you talk a little bit about Ron Paul's influence, both, you know, as a member of the Texas congressional delegation, but you know, Ron Paul as a figure of limited government.
Yeah.
You know, how has he influenced your thinking about government?
Well, obviously, I work closely with Rand, and Rand is obviously his son, and I have good friends that I've known for 25 mm-hmm. years who work with Rand, and I didn't overlap with Ron, but man, what a legacy! And it's not, everybody who says always people go automatically to the Fed, right? Because mm-hmm. it's kind of a thing that he's known for, and that's important because you know how many times do you want to say Ron Paul was right, right? But the notion of limited government is something that has been lost on an entire generation of Republicans. Mm. And I think that at some point here, people are now, to some degree, nostalgically looking back and saying, Ron Paul was right. You know, this is all coming back and the roosters are coming, you know, home to roost. I think that, you know, his legacy is going to build and grow over time.
Yeah.
You know, I think you and I were talking about before a slightly different tangent of the point about limited government. You know, we just were devastated with the floods in Texas yep. that I represent Kerrville. We lost 120 people and you know, obviously well known, there's 27 little girls from a camp. Mm-hmm. And we rallied around and people of faith and all coming together mm-hmm. to help. But I've been really impressed with how much has been happening through philanthropy and local action and state action, less federal. Now, yeah, FEMA, and there are mm-hmm. things in place and there's a lot of those battles to still ensue. But the extent to which the focus has been rightly on the people locally, taking care of people locally, if we don't get back to that, if we don't get back to that notion of limited government, then we're lost. And I think, look, Ron represents a philosophical, bent that I think I'm hoping that there's a new generation of mm-hmm. Americans that will grasp because they'll realize the futility of pursuing this path of unfettered spending that is driving up inflation, making housing completely impossible to afford, making healthcare completely impossible to afford, so you don't ever control your life. Mm. Like, you know, people ask me, why do you do what you do? I'm trying to fight to defend the ability of the American to go achieve the American dream, which they can't do right now.
Right.
We're killing it.
Well, how do you define the American dream there?
Well, the ability to live free and be able to go out and make your
kind
life.
Kind of do whatever you want. So there's not an American dream. It's the American dream is to kind of make your own life.
Yes. And importantly, it's not, you know, and this gets into libertarian, conservative, mm-hmm. conservatarian, whatever you want to say. Like, do whatever you want. Well, there's limits doing whatever you want, right? So in that sphere, but there's the right to go produce, live your life, work, produce for your family, own a home, get a doctor. Mm. Right now, all of those things, if I look at my staff, right, and they're in their 20s or 30s, can they buy a house?
Right.
They don't know.
Yeah.
Can they go get a doctor and get health care? They increasingly limitedly.
No.
Can they buy a car? Can they afford one? Can they send their kids to a school of their choice? Can they, you know, and those things are the center of existence. Yeah. And I think we've got to reclaim that ground. And I think we're too corporatist. We're too, free trade, I believe in, but you got to be smart about like what we're doing here in this country and making sure that, you know, we've got workers here who have jobs in the United States. And so all of these things have got to come together so that you can go put a farm together. You don't have corporatists that are buying up every farm in the, you know, state of Texas. And I'm unable to actually go have the small farm that my parents passed down to me.
Would that be, I mean, it gets complicated, but, you know, what's wrong with corporate farms?
So, and I get that. And
especially if like, well, you know what, they can run more acreage cheaper and produce more crops on it.
I get it. At some point here, maybe this is like Jeffersonian agrarianism popping its head into my UVA background. But,
right, yeah,
but,
yeah.
But look, I'm all for like the freedom to be able to move capital around and make it be efficient. We all are.
Right.
If you believe in free enterprise that way. But there is still something about your home and your community. There is still something about being able to say, this farm, I own this dirt, this farm, I'm building and growing for the people here. And the over-corporatization, and frankly, it's not pure free enterprise corporate. It's corporate crony subsidized corporate, right?
Yeah.
Big ag, where the federal government is mm-hmm. subsidizing big ag at the expense of local farmers. The big government that's subsidizing massive hospitals at the expense of local doctor-owned mm-hmm. facilities or whatever. We put all these bans in place and we funnel all this money, and now it's no longer the balance of a market where a corporation may not be to their advantage to buy up a local thing, but now it is advantaged. I think that's where we've gone awry. No. I'm not asking for restrictions, but I'm just believing that community and the American dream are tied together. And you want to be able to have an investment in your local area. And the free flow of capital is important, but you also got to have, the non-government interfered with free flow of capital.
So should, just to kind of dilate on this a little bit more, should those small farmers be able to hire who they want? Or should they need to go through the federal government and say, oh, no, this person checks out. We said, create a straw man here, but the free flow of goods is good. The free flow of capital, free flow of people. You were very critical of Biden's border policies, and obviously Texas has a huge border with Mexico. But beyond that, what is your view about legal immigration and about letting people who want to come here, who can get jobs and work here? More the merrier, or what are the restrictions?
Yeah, on this one, this is where, in a gathering of my libertarian friends, I'm a little more on the, protect our sovereignty as our country. And it's important that we know who's here and why they're here and making sure that Americans have jobs. And again, in a perfect utopian libertarian world where free flow of capital unfettered by government regulation, government interference, or crony capital, then things would work out, I think, much better with respect to that flow. But you still have to have borders. You still have to know that bad guys are coming.
Nobody's questioned that.
Some do. I mean, I've had some pretty good fiery responses from some of my Cato brothers when they've been in hearings. Yeah. Okay. But and it's fine, and I get it. But should you be able to go get labor if you can't get it? Sure. But there still has to be a component that is factoring in things like anchor babies and birthright citizenship, things that are, which again, I don't understand all the debates, but whether or not they're in schools, whether or not they're on, if you have public programs, again, erase all the public programs. Right. Like I think it was Milton Friedman who said very famously in the 70s, I'm all for open borders if you get rid of the social welfare state.
Actually, basically just said I'm all for open borders.
But he had the component in there about
you
the social welfare state.
Build a wall around the welfare state, not around the United States.
Okay, but the component being, though, with a welfare state, which we massively have, which then completely alters the culture of our country. Yeah. And look, we in Texas are the ones that are sitting here with elementary schools where we have to do English as a second language. We have to do all of the things that cost of that, the hospitals, the healthcare, and locally. And so it's a real issue. You say, well, but you're getting the labor locally and all the tax policy. Well, that's why we have studies.
Right.
But at the end of the day, we have a problem right now where there are American workers who are not working because we're subsidizing them not to work while we're then complaining about needing labor. We've turned it all upside down is my main point.
Right. Is it a question of getting rid of some of those subsidies? When you say we're subsidizing people not to work, there's a lot of Social Security benefits or unemployment benefits or various kinds of medical conditions that keep people off. Yeah, I mean, that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I mean, we had to battle to get work requirements involved with the Medicaid, for example, and work requirements on SNAP and food stamps and whether or not that applies to parents who have kids or doesn't have kids. Right. And, having that battle, which was a whole part of this bill, which we got. We got a lot of requirements in there. But I mean, personally, I'd rather get rid of all that stuff and then make that be state, local churches, charities, et cetera.
Has Ron Paul a Ron Paul sensibility? And, and Ron himself is, is no fan of immigration, really. Like he kind of in the abstract, he should be in favor of it, but then he was often critical of it in specific cases. But is there a Ron Paul flavor to the MAGA movement? Because, it seemed like Ron Paul, certainly in 2008 and 2012, the rise of the Tea Party in 2010, including Rand Paul, including Thomas Massie, Justin Amash, it really seemed like a libertarian version of the Republican Party. Anti-war and the Fed, limit the government was ascendant. And then that kind of shifted gears heavily with the rise of Donald Trump and MAGA.
Well, that's an interesting question, and I haven't really thought about it. I think I'll give you my gut response, and I'll think about it a little bit, which is, I think where we are right now is in a blend of different factors. And part of this, and people talk about MAGA, or they talk about the Freedom Caucus, right? Yeah. I remember meeting with conservatives in the House before the Freedom Caucus existed when I was Ted Cruz's chief of staff. Mm-hmm. It was 2013-14. Then the Freedom Caucus is founded. Then the president comes along, and then it's MAGA and so forth.
Yeah.
And we've had this evolution from 2008 onward. Now we're 17 years into sort of post-Tea Party,
right,
where all of those factors are now, I think, a part of where we are.
Yeah.
And obviously the overriding dominant force is the president and MAGA, but all of that is a piece of the sort of fabric. And so back to the question about Ron, I think I would argue that, for example, some of the stuff about the Fed, some of the stuff about, and I get the stuff about the Federal Reserve and the interest rates, but still there is an anti-Fed, anti-corporate, or I should say government bureaucracy.
It's a very populist.
Yeah, like,
there's Ron Paul is a populist.
And there's that element that is there and driving and part of MAGA. And I do think the part about immigration right now is just recognizing, guys, you know, we're at a point right now where we have 51.5, depending on which reports you look at, 51.5 million people who are foreign born. Mm-hmm. People say, well, who cares? You know, we often have that. Well, that's the highest percentage as our overall population we've really ever had in at least the modern era. Go back to the early 20th century.
Yeah.
But we've allegedly
when
we peaked that
number.
America
became great. Yeah.
Well, okay. So, but what I'm saying is, though, but we also had a culture at that time that was assimilating and saying, learn English and join into the American dream and all of that. And now we've had this kind of counterculture to that, saying, no, you don't have to do that. And you have ESL and everything else. Well, how does that all produce a unified nation with a with a overall environment for success? And so I think that's part of the issue we've got right now.
Well, isn't it? I mean, but I mean, just to kind of bust your chops a little bit, one, you know, is that, you know, Latino immigrants are learning English at the same rate that, you know, my Italian grandparents did.
There's some of that, but there's also a whole lot of.
But I'm saying, like, you know, don't we want people from Cuba and Venezuela, people who are escaping socialism, to come here?
100%.
They're like better Americans than I am.
Well, I got in trouble because I said I would rather deport white liberal Ivy League graduates than would like to invite more people to come in. But otherwise, but look. First of all, the expense for us in the state of Texas to manage that process is very high.
Right.
Second of all, I question that number, because I see a lot firsthand anecdotally in terms of what's happening in terms of language, and talk to a lot of Hispanic Texans who are a little fed up with the sort of, hey, I came here, my parents came here, and they made me learn English, and they made me do this stuff, and now they're seeing a different kind of environment.
So they're not making their kids learn English?
And so, but then there's a wave here, and then there's schools, and then we're in a new era, and I'm just saying, culturally, what we're seeing here is that that's an impact.
Is that, I'm not disagreeing, particularly in, you know, at the border, at the southern border, you know, hospitals and certain other kind of facilities are overrun. And they, if the federal government is saying we're in charge of the border, then they should be kicking in more money to help stressed areas for, you know, for things like that. But, you know, is it immigrants' fault that we don't have a robust conception of what it means to be American? You know, because when I grew up, I'm a little bit older than you, but like I grew up in America was a nation of immigrants.
Yeah.
And that was our whole thing was that, you know, what is great about us, we can take, you know, people from shithole countries and turn them into great Americans, you know, like Joe DiMaggio, et cetera.
Trump got in trouble for saying that.
Like, I know. So, because he meant it, you know, whereas I'm ironic about
it. So what I would tell you is, of course, we're a nation of immigrants, historically speaking, but understand that we're still a nation.
Yeah.
And that has to matter.
Yeah,
that's where I think there's a rubber meets the road issue right now. And like kind of a pause. We've had a massive escalation over the last 30, 40 years. I actually don't care where people are from. Yeah. What I care about is whether they're, you know, proudly putting the American flag up instead of another nation's flag, whether they're proudly joining in with our cause.
I recommend ever come to New York on St. Patrick's
Day. Well, yeah, okay, I get all that. No, but that's, I get that. Yeah. But that's it's one thing when it's a reverent, you know, celebration of a sort of moment or a day of like celebration that way. It's another thing when it's kind of an in-your-face kind of political statement. Okay. And so, but bringing this back to the point, there are a lot of hardworking American families that are hurting right now.
Right.
And they need to be able to have access to jobs. They need to be able to have access to their schools and to their hospitals and to their police. And we've had a flood that is inundated and fentanyl and all sorts of things that have been crushing a lot of our communities. So that pushback is real. And going back to what kicked off this thread of the conversation, I do think that we are in an environment that's blending the sort of libertarian sensibilities, the sort of the Tea Party, the limited government view with a, hey, the federal government has a role here to, you know, stop the flood and deal with the fact that we're now, Texas is getting inundated and other people around the country are getting inundated. And I actually think that's good. I remember we were getting some input from some of the folks in Central America. They're like, we're losing brain drain. We're losing a lot of our good people.
Yeah.
I think we should be, you know, having a stronger policy working with our friends in the Western Hemisphere, building up other countries. I'd love to have this sort of free flow of trade, people moving about, being able to work. But you got to have barriers, not barriers in the sense of
you have processes,
restrictions
right?
and processes that work. Yeah. Nobody disagrees with that. But we do have to have, in my opinion, kind of a cooling off period here to reset and deal with a lot of the mess the Biden administration created. But at the end of the day, what you really need to do is have a small, a smaller federal government focused on its core responsibilities. Because it was actually just doing the basic job of defending the country and defending the borders instead of meddling with all aspects of our lives, then I think they would do a better job of that.
Right. Let me ask you about foreign policy.
Yeah.
Because this is something where, you know, to the extent that the Republican Party has become skeptical of foreign interventions, that seems to be a direct legacy, both of Bush's foreign policy. And I will just be catty for a second and point out that Texas has a terrible record with presidents, right? From LBJ to Bush 1 to Bush 2. But
the LBJ ranch is in my district, by the way.
In Gillespie County, if I'm not mistaken, right? But, you know, Ron Paul is the Republican who said to other Republicans, it is all right to question American foreign policy, like a kind of post-war post-World War II really muscular foreign policy. Do you agree with that or do you feel like it goes too far? You have been, you know, one of the things that's interesting about you is that like you are generally principled and you've at various points have said we should not be intervening, you know, we shouldn't be giving any countries a blank check, but we should be supporting countries, et cetera. Can you explain your foreign policy, and do you think you're reflecting a new Republican consensus that may not be a Ron Paul anti-interventionist, but is certainly not a George Bush kind of neoconservative?
Yeah, funny you say it that way. Is that when I was Senator Cruz's chief of staff, and this is now over a decade ago, we talked about it in the terms of a third approach, like a third way of thinking about foreign policy and national security. Yeah. Look, let me see if I can cut to the chase this way. So I grew up a child of the 80s, right?
Yeah.
Reagan, et cetera. Yeah, you were probably just ahead of me, right?
Yeah.
But like, but you know, that was, you know, as a proud American, it's like, good, you know, beat the commies, let's, you know, tear down the wall, all this stuff. Well, you know, then fast forward and then you kind of have these wars that are ongoing and I'm kind of studying the Middle East and then 9/11, right? And then you're like, you know, you're backing the president. He's like standing on the rubble. It's like, they're all going to hear from us real soon. And you're all kind of there patriotic, wanting to say, yeah, like, let's, what the hell, like, get the bad guys. And then somewhere in that time frame, and I'll get to the exact moment for me, but in that time frame, I started to go, what are we doing? Mm-hmm. Like, we're in endless conflict with no clear mission. And then that kind of reset my thinking. That's about 20 years ago now. And then fast forward, and I took a trip, a rule of law trip to Baghdad in the middle of the war. And went over there and met with people and, you know, did a whole tour. And I just remember I was getting a tour from a 3-star general. And he's taking me up and he's showing me like soccer fields they're building and they're doing all this stuff. And I'm kind of going, I mean, like, this is all well intended, but what the hell are we doing? And it just became very clear to me that there was this whole industry built around this and that wasn't a clear position for America to have a foreign policy position that's about our national defense and that is non-interventionist, to your point. And so I had a kind of new thinking about it. And so where I am today is, like, I just generally believe we should be highly skeptical of I'll use endless wars as the kind of moniker. But and that our driving policy should be, what do we need to do to defend our interests as a nation? If you're going to go and intervene or do something, what is the mission? What can it be done to be done quickly, with the least, you know, amount of cost, loss of life, etc. Defend our position and then get out. But we shouldn't be out and meddling in nation building and all those things. And I think there's a trend in that direction in the right way. I think that has governed a lot of the impulses with respect to Ukraine, mm-hmm. although we're still seeing, and I guess they're going to have this summit in Alaska right. here soon, and we'll see if there's something will come of that. And seeing, you know, hopefully ends of conflicts in a number of different areas, but obviously some still ongoing. And, yeah. you know, I think we need to, and like, we can't do anything about, well, we can't own every skirmish right. or conflict around the world. And I think when we do, I think we sometimes make them worse. I mean, notoriously, Afghanistan, the mm-hmm. Soviet Union, and then, you know, fast yeah. forward, and then all of the complexities and the tangled webs right. you weave. But that all being said, where I break from some of my libertarian brothers and sisters is I do think there are things where we have very specific national security interests where we should be mm-hmm. Engaged. I think that they play long-term benefits. I do think the work with Israel and Iron Dome and other things mm-hmm. I think is beneficial for us. And I get that. And there's debates yeah. within the Republican Party and among libertarians on that
in
point.
In Trump's first term, the yep. Abraham Accords, you know, whatever else you can say about what's going on right. in the Middle East, like that's a major change.
Sure.
And you had, you know, the Arab League actually called for the end of Hamas rule in Gaza. Yeah.
And I still think that's the right driving direction of where yeah. I think and where I believe that the administration wants to go. But obviously there's some different tensions going yeah. on now after the October 7th issue. And look, and I hope that'll all get drawn down and get mm-hmm. to get to peace and that they can get busy rebuilding and dealing with what they're going to do. But by and large, the United States needs to focus on its own house.
Yeah.
And we have not done that. We're $37 trillion in debt. We don't have, I think, the relationships we ought to have throughout the Western Hemisphere to try to minimize the pressure of that immigration flow. And in right. other words, that shouldn't be a political pressure.
Yeah.
It should only be an economic one of mm-hmm. like, oh, yeah, well, if I want a job in X or go to yeah. school, and then we have policies that manage all that. But we don't. We don't have that. And we've been so far strained and so far overextended, in my view.
Yeah.
I mean, we've spent what? I mean, 10 trillion plus at least on whatever we've done over in the Middle East and all of our engagements mm-hmm. over the last 20X years. At one point, I remember it was like 7 trillion and 70 something thousand yeah. injured and 7,000 plus dead. I remember that, but that was like 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And that didn't even count the burn pits, by the way,
right.
which I didn't vote for because it was a $600 or $700 billion entitlement. And that's what we do, though. That's a perfect example. Overextend, endless wars, our guys and gals get hurt, then we create a massive entitlement that we can't afford.
Yeah.
Because there's never any cost benefit that people go, well, all right, what are we going to do? Mm. Well, I don't know. Well, we had some guys over there and they're breathing bad stuff, so $600 billion.
Yeah.
Well, then our kids and grandkids are paying high interest rates and inflation.
Right. As a final topic, and speaking of kind of elections in Texas,
yeah.
Texas right now is doing a novel redistricting,
yeah.
You know, kind of mid-decade redistricting. How do you feel about not the aims of that, but the means of that? Is this legitimate or is this kind of the worst kind of politicking?
So, look, I think, number one, I'm not gerrymandering or gerrymandering, yeah. we should say, right?
Right
it goes
right,
all the way
yeah.
back to the founding.
Yeah.
Nothing new under the sun. California is 40, whatever, to 9. New England is basically mm-hmm. all blue, not right. red, but there are conservative areas there that there could right. be a district if they weren't gerrymandered. Texas is not as gerrymandered as mm-hmm. as some of our blue brothers and sisters yeah. States. And some of that in 2020 was partly a landing place that we landed, where it's like, well, let's consolidate districts that are in a square or rectangular, more mm-hmm. rectangular or more representative portion. I think they ought to stay within county lines. I think representation matters to match the culture in the community right. that you represent. Those are my driving principles, but politics are part of it.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't unilaterally disarm.
So is it okay to redistrict in the, you know, instead of doing it once a year or once a decade based on the
yeah,
census?
There's nothing that says we can't.
Yeah.
It's very clearly political. Right? Yeah. It's just, I mean, I'm not saying anything anybody doesn't know.
Right.
Gerrymandering is political. I think there are seats to be gained there. In full disclosure, we were probably a little soft in how far we could mm-hmm. have gone in 2020. Mm-hmm. I say we have no vote in that in Congress, right? It's the legislature yep. in Texas. And they're taking it up. And look, I think in light of the very close divisions, and wanting to make sure that they've got a majority in the House. And also in light of, without reopening the immigration debate, you got a census issue about citizens, non-citizens, the impact on
well, non-citizens don't vote, though, but they are represented.
Well, but
represented,
and they're represented in the census and count persons, but counting persons, then how are they represented in terms of voting purposes? And that's a debate. And so I think that's a factor in Texas and California and New York and everywhere else. So I think when we factor all that in, I do think that there's room here for the legislature to redistrict. I, you know, again, my political bent or my personal philosophical bent might be the better way to put it is, you know, cleaner lines, less gerrymandered districts. But man, there's, you know, again, you can't unilaterally disarm. So I get the political desire of the legislature to act, but I don't get a say.
Texas, you know, over the course of your time here, and you were telling me before, you're from an old Texas family, but then you grew up in Virginia. But you're back. You know, certainly since the the turn of this century, Texas is the destination. You know, Florida can have whatever it wants, but Texas is not only it's going to become the most populous state in the country probably by 2050, if not before. It is also increasingly the cultural heart of America. It's a it has an identity in a way that California does, or maybe New York. Florida does not, but you know, what? Why do you think people are coming to Texas? Is it the weather? Is it the fire ants? Is it the floods? What, why do people come here? And
you,
why
you
is Texas thriving?
You pick the three things not to come here. Look, you know, when my great grandparents moved out to Dripping Springs, Texas, it was 1853-ish.
Where were they coming from?
So they came from Georgia.
Okay.
And then I had my Roy side of the family came via Tennessee, Arkansas in the 1870s, I think. But in any event, they all converged in that space. And then my family has been in Texas for that last 170-something years. Well, the reason I bring that historic perspective up is it was tough living. I mean, it was, you had to want it. You had to want to deal with, you know, you had hostilities with Comanches. You had tough heat without air conditioning, all the stuff. Like, go down the list. It was tough. And so you had a tough people. And I think that bred a culture that was mixed with a great historic culture that was the Tex-Mex mix and then Germanic mix that came in somewhat illegally too.
And so Texas has been under six flags, right?
Like
different countries. So it's one of the great mixing pits of America.
And I think that, I think all of that has combined though to create a sort of culture though that is Texan, and people are proud of that and they want to adopt that. You know, it's people get surprised. I see people come down and they see a, you know, Hispanic guy in South Texas with a cowboy hat and a big belt buckle, and they go, what's that all about? It's like, well, that's because it's who we are. I mean, you go to a goat roping and, you know, you're going to have a mix of people there. And but I do think importantly, and the thing that I worry about in preserving and protecting Texas, because I think as Texas goes to some degree, the United States goes, is preserving that culture of independence, personal responsibility, where government isn't providing for you. And I'm very worried. I mean, the Texas government is bigger than it should be. We spend more than we should. Texas isn't as free as it should. It is highly regulated, highly regulated. Cato's done some big studies on that that you can go look at. I don't think we're nearly, I don't think we're safe enough. I don't think we're free enough. I think there are things that I think we need to do to improve. But the reason people come to Texas is because of what it represents and because of the freedom to be able to engage in commerce, to be able to live your life. But, you know, I think we're at that, we're at a crossroads. And I think in order to maintain that Texas spirit and that Texas culture, we're going to have to double down on the things that made us great. And that means, in my opinion, a hard move to freedom, a hard move to a truly limited government. You know, you can't go around saying that Texas is, you know, the best thing since sliced bread and the federal government's the problem when you're a state of 30 plus million people and your Austin state government is, you know, we're the size of what, France or whatever. And if our state government is bureaucratic, then we're not what we ought to be. So we've got work what we need to do there, but it's a great state with a great mix of people and people who respect, what it means to work hard and to make their own lives. And I think the tech boom is a little bit that. It's the modern version of that. Like, there's a reason Elon comes and puts Tesla. There's a reason that we've had a huge tech community because they like that I'll call it libertarian spirit and ability. I think from a free enterprise standpoint, Texas is pretty free. Yeah. I think from a regulatory compliance, et cetera, standpoint, property taxes, there are things that we need to do to improve freedom in Texas and be the beacon of hope for the next century.
Sure. Chip Roy, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks, Nick. Appreciate you guys.